Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
All right, Dan, we have Toronto on the line. Say hi to Jeff.
Jeff who?
What's up, buddy?
Hey, homie. From ABC, this is the 10% Happier podcast. I'm Dan Harris. I don't know how much I've talked about this or alluded to it, but 2017 was not a super easy year for me. I had some personal stuff go on that was tough and some professional stuff that was tough. And on top of that, I did, I'm glad I did it, but it was a bit of a boneheaded thing where I agreed to take on this massive extracurricular project in the form of a book that's coming out on December 26th. Called Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics. And we, because I wrote it with a few other people, including one of whom you're going to hear from in a minute, wrote it on an incredibly tight deadline. I mean, it's just absurd. And it was layered on top of my very busy day job where I've, you know, two shows that I do here at ABC News and, you know, I have this podcast and startup company, the 10% Happier app, and I also have a wife and a child. And this book thing just, I didn't think through how much work it was going to be. And it really almost broke me. And so in this conversation with Jeff Warren, who is my principal co-author on the book, we'll get into the whole story because... So Jeff and I, along with Carly Adler, who came in to sort of help us to kind of keep the trains running on time, we decided to write this book, which is kind of a companion slash follow on to 10% Happier. The idea is, you know, in 10% Happier, I told a funny story that I hopefully would get you to meditate. But then I realized after the book came out, and especially after I started the app, that I really got a sense that people have trouble, even if they want to meditate, adopting the habit in an abiding fashion. So I wanted to write a book that that would help people actually do the practice. But I'm not a meditation teacher, so I wanted to recruit a true meditation teacher. So I got Jeff Warren, who's based in Toronto. He runs an amazing meditation group up there called the Consciousness Explorers Club, and I've been a fan of his for a long time. He's really funny and really cool, and so he's the full package. He's really charming. I often call him my man crush. So Jeff and I decided to do this book together. And the first thing we did was we took this cross-country road trip where we met all sorts of people, celebrities, cops, military cadets, all sorts of people and who want to meditate but aren't. And we helped them get over the hump. But then when we got home, the trouble started because we had to write the book on a really tight deadline and in the process kind of nearly killed each other. So we did this podcast together. This is the second of four podcasts that we're doing during the month of December, special podcasts, all kind of around leading up to the release of the book on December 26th. But this is kind of the behind the scenes, the behind the music version of Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics. We're going to hear like how crazy and neurotic we were about making it and how it kind of brought out some of our deepest idiosyncrasies, flaws, and foibles and at times created some conflict. But this conversation really kind of tied a ribbon around it for me because, you know, sometimes when you have an intense and difficult experience with a friend, it ends the friendship or it cements the friendship. And in this case, as I think you're about to hear it, the latter is true, and I'm very grateful for that. So here he is, one of my all-time favorites, Jeff Warren. All right, man. So you just got the physical copy of the book. How did that feel?
Yeah, it felt good. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, I'm just amazed at how fast the turnaround was. I mean, it was this epic adventure, epic writing adventure. The production happened so fast, and now it's a reality. And I think about the first book I wrote, which was like this, you know, it dragged out over multiple years with long edits and torturous back and forth with editors. And this was very painless. So, I mean, but quick and intense, but it felt great. I mean, we did it. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I've only written one other book and it was what you described, like many years and all this angst. And this one was an enormous amount of angst and pain and sleeplessness, but it was concentrated. So we did the road trip in January of 2017, and the book is coming out in December of 2017. That is a very fast book. I hope, I mean, as a consequence, it doesn't suck.
Me too. I don't think it does. But it's a very intense turnaround. I mean, it's basically unheard of in the to do something that to come out that quickly. That's what I was amazed by.
So I don't have much of an agenda for this conversation, other than like just giving people, a kind of behind the scenes look at how it came about and how we did it, and you know, pulling back the curtain a little bit. So let me ask you, from your perspective, how did you get involved in this project?
I guess it starts with our relationship, which was, I wrote that piece in, I think it was 2012.
In the New York Times.
In the Times. Yeah, and then you got hold of me, and I didn't even know who you were because I don't even have a freaking TV. And you're like, hey, I work at ABC, I'm interested in meditation. I'm like, okay, who's this guy? And because I get all kinds of weird emails from random people asking me about consciousness. I mean, that's like kind of part of the lifestyle at this point. And so I was like, oh, yeah, this guy seems nice. And we had a bit of a back and forth. But then I just kept up. You know, you'd send me a note once in a while. I guess you'd see something. Oh, you subscribed to CEC newsletter. And then
CEC is your group, the Consciousness Explorers Club in Toronto. The you co-founded a meditation and other stuff group, which is awesome. And the newsletter is just so well written that, as I joked in the book, it's like the only time in my life I've ever wanted to move to Canada.
Yeah. Although, yeah. And those were the hurly burly days of the Consciousness Explorers Club when we were really experimenting with all kinds of stuff and writing these ecstatic emails. And so you would send me these notes saying, oh, I really like that. I like that. And then you started telling me that you had this idea for a book, that you had this idea that you wanted to do and you weren't sure it was going to work. And you were very humble and modest about it. And meanwhile, it came out and ended up being this mega bestseller, 10% Happier. And then we just kept up, you know, back and forth. And at some point, we hung out in New York, I think it was, came down and we had dinner.
Actually, you came down, we had lunch way before 10% Happier came out. And then you came down another time with your then girlfriend, now wife, Sarah, and I had dinner with you and a bunch of people. And then I saw you I was up in Toronto and we had spent. It wasn't just like we were pen pals. We were actually like hanging out.
Oh, yeah, totally. And it was fascinating. I mean, for me, it's really interesting to see, like when you get into this stuff, you really get into this stuff. And to have another, you know, kind of compadre that you can totally nerd out about and talk about the deep end stuff, but talk about the accessible stuff. And I could just see you getting psyched about all the things that I was psyched about. So, you know, it's exciting to have that kind of a relationship, and especially when it feels like the thing you're figuring out together is like, you know, the mind or reality or how to be in the world. You know, it's like such a fundamental thing that you're excited about. It's like you could be psyched about sports, you could be psyched about elephants, you can be psyched about all these different subjects, but when your subject matter is how to exist as a human being, there's definitely something highly motivating about those kinds of friendships and relationships. And I think that was a big part of what happened for us at the start, was this, the really just being psyched to kind of talk about this. What are the limits of this, you know? And also, particularly because it's not talked about in sort of the intellectual mainstream or the mainstream itself, the dimensions of change that can happen through these kinds of practices. It's sort of talked about in this generalized way, this sort of soft Dharma way, but nobody really is publicly explores the specifics of that, it seems like, although that's starting to change. So it also felt like this subject matter that was very fresh, that was mysterious, you know, that was, and yet hugely relevant. And so having a friend to bounce stuff off was just, you know, for me, I loved it.
Yeah, so well said.
Still
that do. Is perfectly articulated. That's exactly the way I feel. And which is why I thought of you when I decided to write a follow-up. I don't know if it's a follow-up or a companion piece. I don't know what I would describe this next book as, but basically the animating insight for me in terms of this new book, Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, was that on my first book, 10% Happier, I had this naive assumption that people who read it, you know, would start meditating because I thought I made a reasonably good case. But that is so, that is to completely miss the complexity of what it takes for people to form a good habit, and the difficulty that people face when they're when they want to change aspects of their behavior. And I learned that very powerfully after the book came out, and I started the 10% Happier app, where you, Jeff, you've done some amazing work for us. You've done a great course on there with us and audio meditations. But in the course of working for that company, I mean, it became very obvious to me that there are all these obstacles that people face to actually doing the thing. So even if you read a book or meet a friend and get inspired and think, okay, I should start meditating, then there are time issues, there are misconceptions around, can I clear my mind, or do I have to clear my mind, or is this going to somehow lose my edge? Is this self-indulgent? And so that's why I wanted to write the follow-up book, to actually help people do the thing. And I reached out to you because, you're one of the most awesome guys I know. So I thought it would work well, and it did.
Yeah. It's interesting. I realize how much I, in a way, didn't understand about what it takes to make a meditation practice work before writing this book. Like, I've always been really focused on the inner game. So what are the mental skills that we're building in practice? Like, really trying to understand those from the inside. And I've had a great teacher in Shinzen Young who really helped me with that. And so that's been the real focus of my teaching. And, it was only through writing this book with you that I realized there's an external game as well. And actually, that external game is every bit as important for a practice. And that has to do with how you create the structure, the container that's going to hold you in a practice, how you create the support system, with a community or friends or teacher, how you structure the practice itself, how you fit it into your schedule, what it takes to create a routine. That stuff was all, in a way, fresh learning for me. Like, I kind of knew vaguely about it and based on what was working for me and my friends. But I think a lot of people who don't make it in a practice, it's for those external reasons. And it made me realize that actually that is part of the practice. It's not just what you do on the cushion. It's just getting you there. That is half the work, if not even three quarters of the work,
Yeah, I think that was what I learned, that I didn't know before we started writing and researching this book, that there is so much to learn and to know about what it takes to get somebody on the cushion, or what it gets to take anybody to do anything that makes them healthy. One of the things I learned in researching the science around behavior change or habit formation is, we didn't evolve as a species for long-term health planning. We evolved for, immediate gratification in the form of food and sexual partners, or threat detection in the form of, like, running away from saber-toothed tigers. And so evolution doesn't care about your long-term health. Evolution cares that you survive long enough to get your DNA into the next generation. And therefore, we are not naturally inclined to do things like exercise and eat healthy and get enough sleep. All the stuff that we know from the science is good for us, because it's just, like, not the mind and the brain that was bequeathed to us by millennia of evolution. So it was just so fascinating to learn about that and to see how to apply it in real time. And I want to talk about some of the applications we came up with, but just to stay with the chronology of the story. So I came to you, I believe, at the end of 2016, and I said, "Hey, Jeff, I'm writing this little book. We're going to rent a rock star tour bus and go across the country and meet a bunch of people who want to meditate and aren't, and figure out how to help them get over the hump. And it's going to take 11 days, and you're going to have to be away from your home and probably eat bad food. And I have no idea. And then we're going to have to crash a book on a very short time frame." Why did you say yes to that?
I mean, who wouldn't say yes to that? And first of all, there's the adventure. So just the idea of going across the states and meeting, I mean, what I liked about the project was that it was sort of applied mindfulness, the journalistic side of it, like actually meeting real people who are trying to apply it, who were stuck in different ways and what they were doing. And I mean, that's an incredible opportunity. You're taking out of most of the Dharma books I'd read, or most Buddhist books or meditation books. It's like, oh, this is what you got to do. But it wasn't, in occasion there's quotes from people having different challenges, but this was actually meeting real people with real in entire worlds, you know, the world of the like military, the world of like politics, the world of celebrityness, and looking at their actual jobs and then saying, well, how could this help, or what were they finding were the challenges? I mean, so that was really the big draw for me, was that there it was going to be this adventure and then to actually meet with the real people, which would really kind of ground it in the world. So that was, I mean, that was it. And then also, of course, it's, you know, it's just fun. It's fun to hang out with you. You know, you're always making jokes. We have a good time together. And having my buddy Eddie on board was like a huge motivator too.
Eddie Boyce, the amazing Eddie Boyce, who is our creative director, who oversaw all the video production. And there's a ton of it, which we'll be posting all over the place. And also you can see on the app. Eddie Boyce is the man.
He's the man. And then there's just the randomness of like life drops these opportunities, and then it's like, okay, well, why not? You know, I never would have thought about this in a million years that I would have done something like that. In fact, I was, you know, as I'm sure we'll talk down the line in this talk, my propensity is to go to the deep end and think about the more complex stuff, and often at the at the detriment of understanding the kind of wide end or ways of making it accessible. So I often don't think in that mode. And so you kind of forced me into that. So I realized there was a huge growth opportunity for me as a teacher and as a thinker to be, to kind of expand my repertoire too. So that was also part of it.
Although I want to say in your defense, so we will talk about this, and it gets talked about a lot in the book, how we basically wanted to kill each other because my propensity for being just kind of mean and your propensity for spinning off into these like esoteric theories that when I'm trying to like get us to write a book about basic meditation. But, you know, in the moment when we're out on the tour, on the bus, and it was hectic and hard, you know, we had this incredible schedule where every day was, you know, we were meeting these people and shooting all this footage and then getting back on the bus and driving hundreds and hundreds of miles. It was really intense. But you were to take a meditation teacher who most of whom are nobody ever like criticizes or gives notes to a meditation teacher. Hey, you know, I don't think you did that meditation right. Like they're treated, you know, like they're made out of porcelain mostly. And to take a meditation teacher, throw them on a bus full of, you know, random people and awesome people from the 10% happier world, but still you didn't know most of them, and throw you into these crazy situations where, you know, one day we'd be sitting with the singer Josh Groban, the next we'd be hanging out with cops in Tempe, Arizona, or social workers in New Mexico, or formerly incarcerated youth. I mean, we programmed this thing to be incredibly diverse. You displayed an incredible ability to wade into whatever environment we concocted and just totally lock in on what the needs were at that moment and help people get excited about meditation in a way that I think made them more likely to actually adopt it as an abiding habit. So I want to say that in your defense before we later on pick on you.
I appreciate it. That's very nice of you to say. Although, you know, I think part of it is part of it probably has to do with being pretty ADD. When you're ADD, you're just able to reset. You know, it's just, that's kind of one of the qualities of being ADD. It's like you don't last long in whatever microclimate of mood that you're in. You just boop, you reset in the new moment. So that's just that part of my pathology, if you want to call it that, is actually quite helpful for showing up in the moment and being, and particularly if it's a kind of adventurous situation. So I just think it's ironic that, you know, my biggest mental challenge is also part of what can help me, actually help me out sometime as a teacher. So it's
say more about ADD, because, you know, you had mentioned to me many times that you had ADD, but especially on the road trip, you mentioned it came out a lot. I'll be honest, I never really took it seriously. I mean, not that I was being disrespectful. You didn't seem it. Like you had gone to, you know, really elite college and had written a very successful book and had a really successful meditation career. And so I don't know. People often say these days, oh, I'm super ADD. So I just never I didn't take it that seriously, and it wasn't until we got into the writing process where it became very obvious that actually this is a huge thing for you, and it became very difficult between the two of us. But just take us back a little bit. Like, when did you know that you had ADD, and what kind of problems did it cause?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, and it's I'm kind of just learning to talk about it, you know, publicly. You know, it's something I've struggled with my whole life, but part of being ADD is that sometimes it's hard to see the big picture of what's going on. So it started when I was a kid, just being like a lot of kids, having like I had really more the ADHD then, like super hyperactive, attention all over the place. They've been thinking about renaming ADD executive function disorder. So it means all the kind of normal things that come with a healthy functioning frontal lobe, like impulse control, planning, organizational, prioritizing, those kinds of things. They're just not as well developed. And that's normal for a kid. So lots of kids have ADD. But once at a certain point, you start to grow out of it and you start to develop more of those frontal cognitive capacities, although you can make an argument that with the technology these days, everyone is getting a little bit more ADD, that those some of those inhibitory mechanisms aren't coming online as fully. So for me, it was just being very dysregulated and all over the map and super hyperactive and
as
crazy
a kid,
as a
especially.
Kid.
Yeah.
As a kid, like a disaster nightmare. I mean, my parents literally had me in a leash. Like there's apparently some picture of me at the zoo with like a full body harness on, you know, running full speed towards the, you know, chimpanzee tanks or whatever they were, and getting yanked back. So that was me.
I don't mean to have any disrespect. I'm not laughing out of any disrespect for parents who have to put kids on a leash. No. I'm laughing out of disrespect for you, but not for other kids who, you know, this is a serious issue. And I know you had a serious issue, and so I'm not really disrespect for you, but I'm laughing because basically I felt like there were many times when I wanted to put a leash on you, and so now knowing that your parents had a leash on you just fills me with all sorts of satisfaction.
Yeah, my friends love that story. They never fail to remind me about it. So to give you a bit of the history in terms of how ADD develops, you know, so for a lot of people, like young boys especially, but young girls too, and now they're beginning to realize there's different types of ADD, but a lot of it you kind of grow out as you get through your teenage years and you kind of consolidate things and you kind of come online more in that way. And I actually think that has started to happen for me, but then I had this huge head injury where I, at 21 or 20, where I fell out of a tree. I was high and I just was with my friends. We were playing like football on the road and I climbed up this tree. And anyway, it was a bit of a ridiculous situation. I fell, I broke my neck. I dislocated my spine and fractured the vertebrae in C6, C7. And I had a pretty big head injury where my head just got really, I hit a parked car on the way down. It was a pretty big fall. And after that, I was in traction for a month. I was in halos, and it was sort of 6 months to recover. But I really, it knocked me back into a super ADD space that I didn't understand really at the time. I just knew that I wasn't processing stuff in quite the same way. And that's actually when my real interest in consciousness and the mind started, because I was like, well, what's going on here? Why am I more, like, I thought I was better from this ADD stuff. But now I was really ADD. And this is where it's important to make a distinction for people who think, oh, yeah, I'm a little bit ADD. I know what that's like. Or people who underplay it. Like, real ADD is really a serious problem. It causes a ton of suffering in people. And because the experience is that you can't ever get your together. You start on a track thinking about something and you're bouncing off five tracks laterally. You can't complete anything. So there's this sense of guilt or a sense of like, your own incompetence, and you don't know what's going on because the thing, it's like you're in a car that can't stay on the road and you think it's your fault, you know, like, well, what's wrong? It's a failure of character somehow that I can't just see through on these projects, you know, and I'd go from one project to another or one city to another, one partner to another, like romantically, like I couldn't stay with anything. And so there was no lasting satisfaction. Like, even though I was a very fun-loving, happy person on one level, and I loved partying, and of course that would just feed into the ADD thing, I wasn't ever able to, you know, follow through on things, and it was very frustrating, and actually more than frustrating, it was like, you know, after a while, you're like, why am I even here? You know, because you can't, even relationships don't feel like they're as deep as they could be because you're just not present for them, you know, or all the normal satisfactions of being meaningfully connected to work, of seeing things through, the feeling of like beginning something and finishing something. And like that, you know, for all through my 20s, that really wasn't there. And then and even into my 30s, and then there's a period in my mid-30s where suddenly I kind of got my shit together. Like, I got a good job at CBC. I managed to write this book about consciousness.
CBC, which is the Canadian broadcasting company, where you were a radio journalist.
And it fed into my ADD because you're just jumping around from idea to idea. So that was cool. But, and they had, I had wonderful bosses who really cared about me, and they could see that I had, because the benefit of ADD, of course, what everyone says is that you do have a lot of creativity because you're just skipping tracks all the time. So you get to access this very wide pool of data. And that's, so it's great for journalism. It's great for ideas, for a certain kind of creativity. And that was, and that kind of got me through that. And then even writing Head Trip, like I, you know, that book is, I mean, it's sort of a cult thing. People really like it. It's got a ton of cool stuff in it, but it's a lot of information. You know, it's like a 500 page book with like tons of footnotes. And I look at it now and like, I'm like, wonder how my editors even let that out in the world. You know, it's very much an ADD thing. So it was, so,
can I just interrupt you? Cause I think a lot of people, and I'm not interrupting to change the subject, I'm interrupting to just amplify your point, which is, I think a lot of people think that ADD means you can't pay attention to, you have no ability to pay attention to anything. But in fact, what I learned about you, first of all, one thing I learned is that there are many flavors of ADD. And the other thing I learned is that your specific flavor is that actually you get like manic about stuff. Like you get, I think as you described it, you get so entranced and entangled by an idea that you like build this treehouse in your mind and then you climb up and live in that treehouse.
That actually is one of my favorite quotes. It comes from Saul Bellow, who is a master of talking about the human mind and how we kind of make these traps for ourselves. But that's exactly it. I mean, there's a hyper-focus aspect to a lot of people with ADD where you're either in a skipping track mode, or then when you lock in on something you're interested in, it's like you're hyper-focused. And the part of the reason you're hyper-focused is because you're worried about losing the focus. So you have to hold on to it so tight because you're always losing the focus in your life. And so people are trying to pull you out of that, but you're like, you don't want to leave because this is you finally got it locked down, you know? So, you know, it's really, and that was a huge learning in this book because I've always known I've had that capacity, but I never really thought about it in the terms of ideas and thinking and writing itself. You know, it was just a big illuminating process to write this book with a partner who would be like, in a sort of delicately, you know, dude, and sometimes not so delicately, you're really off on this tangent here and it's not connecting to the immediate needs of the moment. And I would have to like pull myself out of that. And I have to say meditation has been enormously helpful for that. And the thing that I struggle with in this respect is the thing that everyone struggles with, which is that we get our fixations up. We get in our entranced with our ideas, our notions of how things need to be. And the way Saul Bellow put it was that it's like we build these tree houses and we go up and live in them. And then we imagine the tree house is the world, but all around is the forest and it's humming with possibility and mystery. But we only see our own. It's not only do we build these tree houses, but we like pave them with these. We put like mirrors on the inside and we're just looking at our own ideas reflected back at us. And what's fundamentally transformational about an insight practice is it allows us to pop out of those kinds of situations, pop out of that trance and say, oh my God, you know, I was inside this mood. I was inside this idea. I was inside this conviction, believing that this was how things needed to be. But if I am able to just notice this as this smaller part of this one part of my experience, you know, as I would say, the figure inside the ground, you know, just like the tree in front of a background of mountains, realize that I'm in the tree, and you pop out of the tree, and now suddenly you can see the forest, you can see the mountains, and you realize that you have options, that you can move into a different place when you need to. And that is absolutely, I mean, that's what we talk all about in the book again and again, and that is the liberating, absolutely liberating dimension of an insight or a mindfulness practice, and it can be repeated again and again, and it will be repeated again and again, because it doesn't matter how many times you hear it, you will be once again stuck in your trance. You'll be stuck in your treehouse, imagining that this is how things need to be. So, you know, I have so much gratitude for my teachers who, you know, took with great patience, would show me this again and again, again and again. This ADD kid who was just a dysregulated partier who just did not have it together. But again and again, Jeff, can you come back right now? What is happening? Can you feel this sensation, this sense of being fixated on this idea? Can you notice, you know, the thought pattern itself? In the act of noticing, in the act of feeling, can you notice that you're not in it anymore? How does that feel? It's like, oh my God, are you really? Why didn't they teach me this in school? And, you know, I know, so, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, I know what you're talking about on several levels. One, because obviously I like every human being that's who has ever existed, I get stuck in my own trances and lose sight of the greater picture. But I also know what you're talking about when you talk about your teachers having to pop you out of an obsession or fixation. And I'm realizing, like, the way you talk about your teachers doing that, the way the writing process got set up, in other words, we got back from the road trip and we had like 2 minutes to write a book. And, you know, I think the pace that we were on was that, because I was doing the first draft, so I had to do a chapter a week in order for us to be on on time, which is insane. It was insane. And almost killed me. And but in the process, like, you were writing the meditation instructions, which, by the way, are beautiful and brilliant, but in some of the early iterations were also beautiful and brilliant, but incredibly long and often, you know, mired in esoterica. And so I had to do what your teachers, you just described your teachers doing, say, hey, Jeff, yeah, you know, like, notice, you know, can you pop out of your obsession and be with whatever's happening right now? Except for I didn't do it in a nice way. Like, the way you described your teachers doing it, it's filled with compassion. But I was pissed and I was tired and I was stressed and I had a day job and a family that I was dealing with, and then trying to write this book with a gun to my head. And so it got a little tense there. So what can you describe that from your point of view?
Yeah. I just think it's so funny that I'm supposed to be the meditation teacher and I'm like, I'm totally hopelessly, you know, lost in my thing, and you're the one who's popping me out. But yeah, from my point of view, things started good, well enough when we got into it. We knew we had a loose structure in terms of what we had these experiences. First of all, the road trip. And then we had these ideas of, we knew these different ways in which people got confused in their practice. And so Carly did a phenomenal job of helping us, you know, helping you create outlines first and then ultimately write each of those chapters, at fusing both the story of what was happening on the road.
So we should say Carly is the third author on the book. So it's Dan, Jeff, Carly. So, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. So, that was already that's just a huge amount of work to figure out, okay, what are these different challenges that people are having? How can we fit that into the actual course of the narrative that we had? And then the third piece is, and how can we build a curriculum that's going to teach people meditation in a way that makes sense along the same trajectory? So those are three different tangents that we were trying to weave together, like three sort of threads. So
yeah, just to emphasize that. Sorry. So just to emphasize that, we were trying to build. It was super Rube Goldberg. We wanted to have a chronological narrative built into the road trip, but we also wanted every chapter in the book to address a specific obstacle to meditation. So we had to line up. We had to make sure that the road trip in some way progressed not only through time and space, but also through these ideas in an orderly way. So the first one is about people fearing that they can't clear their mind. The second one is about not having enough time. The third one is fearing that somehow meditation is going to make you look weird. But we had to superimpose I don't know what was being superimposed on what, but we were superimposing the narrative on top of the sort of order of pedagogical ideas about, like, attacking these various obstacles, or we're doing it the other way around. I can't figure out. And then on top of all that, we wanted to teach you basic meditation in many, many permutations. So it was really hard to do. And you're right that Carly Adler, the third co-author on the book, was incredibly helpful in helping us figure that out.
Oh, my God, yeah. She's brilliant and a saint and very patient with both of us in all the different neurotic ways that we are. She seemed to be the most, like, just this amazing nurturing force that kind of kept the whole thing going.
Amen.
But just to, well, so to come back to the story, so you're there doing the chapters and you're building the narrative and you're working and you're elaborating all the behavioral science stuff, which is so interesting. And my job was to kind of figure out, okay, well, how can we create a teaching progression? So at first I felt like it was hard for me to get into it because I was sort of waiting for to see what the outline, what is the structure that we're building here in terms of those other two strands. And then when I started thinking about it, I thought, okay, I got this great idea that I want to do, I think this should be an exploration of the entirety of insight practice, the depth from the surface of the mind to the depths. This is going to be a progression from like how we first start noticing that we can get stuck in thoughts to what those thoughts are made of, to the feelings and the images, and then to the fact, the larger idea of the patterns, and then the deeper idea of like disembedding from sensory experience, and then going into the profound nature of mind. And I had this whole like, and then I sent you this long, like 14-page document, I think, that had like all of this, like, and I thought it was, you know, it was like, I'm like, yes, this is going to be it. This is going to take people not only from introductory meditation, but they're going to start to understand the deep end of the pool. And I sent this document very proudly thinking that this was really going to solve all our problems. And I think you looked and you were like, oh my God, I don't even understand what this guy's writing here. I mean,
yeah,
maybe
no,
you can
no.
tell
it,
me from your experience.
It threw me off the deep end. Like I was, because I was at this point so frayed and frazzled from trying to balance my day job as a journalist with, you know, the family and having a young child, and then this massive responsibility that got ladled on top that I had completely underestimated how bad it was, this process was going to be. I'd walked into this like Elmer Fudd.
As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected. After investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile. Third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans.
And so I was just hanging on by a thread, and I needed like help and support to make sure I got from chapter to chapter. And I just wanted you to write simple, practical meditations that plugged in that I didn't have to worry about. And then you sent me this 14-page memo that like used, that was so, it was actually, you know, having looked at it after I calmed down, it was really great. I mean, totally great. But for like, it was a book in and of itself, and it's for like hardcore deep end meditation practitioners. So I was like, what am I supposed to do with this? Like, I was just, and I got mad, which we'll talk about my anger issue, which really came out not only in the process of dealing with you, but just also came out in my process. It came out through the course of the book in terms of my learning how angry I get with myself and how mean I am to myself. Yeah. And you really helped me deal with that. So we should get to that. But yeah, so that the memo, just to get back to the story, the memo completely, I lost my mind when I read it.
Yeah. And you know, I think, you know, you were, I mean, this is the thing about stress. It's like you're under a huge amount of stress. You're freaking barely sleeping. You're doing two jobs. So you're reactive. You know, that's why we do this practice, you know. And so I think it's funny that everything we were writing about in the book, everything we're trying to communicate in the book, we are ourselves fighting with and wrestling with and dealing with in this intense deadline. You've got your reactivity. You're burned out and you're starting to become basically a and then I've got my total distractibility and I'm like off in the clouds doing my thing. And it's more than, you know, I realized, you know, so when you go off in that, into your own idea space, you're not connecting to what's really going on the ground with other people. And so in a way, I actually wasn't empathizing fully with what you were dealing with. I didn't really realize I could see that you were stressed, but that was my own fixation on thinking, oh, this is the right way to do things, was actually preventing me from seeing what was going on with you. And so when I started to see that was happening, I tried to sort of disembed, but it took a few, took a couple times to, we'd had a few trial runs, and then eventually we got back into a good flow, and then it just sailed from there.
Yeah, it did. I mean, I'm extremely pleased with where it ended up, and in that, you know, I'm just going to sing your praises, is going to embarrass you, but so sorry. But, like, you know, there are many, many, many great meditation books out there, but very few of them get read very frequently. And the parts of the book that are yours, where you just teach people how to meditate, I've never seen such funny and fresh writing about how to do the practice that will actually, like, make you laugh as you're reading it, but also give you practical advice and also just pique your curiosity and get you excited to do the thing. So where we ended up was a great place, but it was tough to get there.
Yeah. I mean, there was that 1 month, but overall, I mean, I guess, you know, I just loved the experience. And what really came down in the end was that I got to actually finally talk about who I was, like, in terms of the challenges that I have. And that never would have happened if it wasn't for you. Like, you kept encouraging me. Once you realized that anything was going on, you got really interested in it. And you started asking me, you know, what is that like? And when did that start? And you tried to draw, you slowly started drawing me out more. And I never talk about this stuff. Like, this is why I've always had a lot of ambivalence about, you know, me being a teacher. Like, I didn't even want to be a teacher. Like, I never thought about it. It was nothing that occurred to me. I was a writer and a neurotic writer at that, like many writers. And it was only Shinzen constantly encouraging me, saying, look, you have a gift for talking about the mind or thinking about this stuff. You should be out there. And I would be like, well, I don't want to be out there. I mean, who am I? I'm not some model of mental health. I'm so flawed and screwed up. Like, but he kept encouraging me. And so I did my thing in Toronto with that encouragement, and people would come around more because I was a writer, and we had just a fun big group of friends. And it just was this fun informal thing. And I guess teacherliness, or whatever you want to call it, kind of developed through that. But there was always this feeling in my mind that I was like an imposter, like, because I wasn't naturally calm and placid. I wasn't like Joseph Goldstein or Sharon Salzberg or all these amazing people who are just like, who of course deal with their own stuff and are totally honest with it, but are so obviously are so obviously the beneficiaries of this practice. And I was a beneficiary of the practice, but it's like you say, 10%, 20%, it can help in huge ways, but there's still these fundamental ways in which you're challenged. And just having you encouraging me to talk about that, it felt like I have so much gratitude. And like, I feel emotional talking about it, because I felt like I don't have to lie anymore. I could just say, yeah, this is me. And I'm pretty f***ed up, but I still meditate. And it's helpful to me in a lot of different ways. And I can talk about how it's helpful, and I can talk about how it's not. And there needs to be more of this in our culture, of people saying, yeah, I'm having these troubles when it comes to my mind. And it's not just external conditions that are causing challenges, like, oh, I'm having trouble with this job, or I'm having trouble with this thing over here. So we bring these conditions to the table and we don't talk about them. And it's so profound, these internal struggles. And the more we can just admit to them, then it's like, that is the insight process. We see them, we admit to them, we're no longer as stuck in them, as opposed to ruminating on our own or thinking that we're uniquely doomed. And so this was a very healing project for me. And it wouldn't have happened if we hadn't had those challenges in the writing, and you hadn't encouraged me to kind of be more out that way. And so I have, you know, so aside from the fact that you're an amazing writer and an awesome guy, like, I have a lot of gratitude for you for just, you know, trusting in me and allowing me to have this kind of a change, this kind of a awakening, I guess you could say.
There's an expression that my Yiddish grandmother used, or Jewish grandmother, but it's a Yiddish expression that she used to use, which is naches. Like, it's when a grandmother or anybody sees somebody they love and they're just so proud of them. That's the feeling I get when I listen to you talk or when I read your parts of the book. And I don't mean that in any way, like from a paternalistic standpoint. We're the same age, and I look at you as my teacher. So if anything, the authority runs the other way. But I mean it more for as a friend. You know, to realize in the basically, just to step back for 1 second. So, you know, once we realized that you and I were having a problem and that the root of it was the ADD, what I ended up doing was just co-opting that and turning it into a plot line in the book, which meant that you reluctantly, I had to get you to talk about it candidly so that I could write about it. So I ended up really injecting this into the book, which you did not go into the book process thinking you were going to be revealing to the world. But what was so beautiful for me to watch was to understand that this was something you were really insecure about, that you were basically an amazing meditation teacher who had imposter syndrome, who felt like you didn't deserve to be a teacher, and that this was a albatross for you. And I had the privilege of being able to watch you realize that what you thought was a liability is actually a strength. That because you have these challenges and are willing to speak openly about them, you connect better to people who, and by the way, that in the end is the whole damn point, which is to connect better to people and teach them how to do this thing and lead happier, more productive lives. And so to watch you kind of, a guy who I had you know, deeply admired for many, many years, ever since that article in 2012 in the New York Times, feel as confident and as awesome as everybody around you who knows you to be. That was an amazing thing to watch.
Well, thanks, man. I mean, it wouldn't have happened without you. So I feel, like I said, I feel a lot of gratitude. And yeah.
So I don't know what to say.
It's like emotional. So
yeah, and I don't want to make you feel too uncomfortable because I know unlike me, you don't have narcissistic tendencies. So as somebody with narcissistic tendencies, I will now steer the conversation back to me. Well, but with a big dose of you, because I want to talk about a way in which you really helped me. It really starts because this theme is big. We tell the story in the book, but it's worth talking about now too. I think is you, as we were on the road trip and living in this tin can together, driving across the country, often under great stress and with a lot of fatigue because, you know, the schedule was so crazy and, you know, eating junk on the road. So not, you know, somewhat suboptimal circumstances, although it was also a blast, and we should get to that too. But you started to know something about me that I had been insecure about but hadn't really let myself see, which is that I am very committed to the practice of meditation. And yes, there are times when I have very satisfying experiences on the cushion, but much of my practice was shot through with this eat your vegetables, gulag, forced march type of atmosphere, and I think rooted in part. So your initial insight was, Dan, I'm not sure you like meditation that much. Like you have this kind of aggressive attitude towards your own mind in some ways, and the practice feels sort of stern and severe with the way you do it. But that grew into a realization that all of that came out of the fact that I struggle with a lot of anger. And I tie it back to my grandfather, Robert Johnson, who was a really angry guy and not very nice. And you helped me sort of see that I had this inner Robert Johnson that was very mean to myself. And I think that made meditation kind of unpleasant because every time I got distracted, I would just holler at myself. And so that whole process wasn't so supple or seamless. And then that also obviously had its external manifestation, which we saw in its full glory during the aforementioned, you know, month of discontent when we were struggling over the writing of this book. And really seeing that and teaching me ways to work with it was hugely valuable. And I would say the two things you taught me, and I want you to hold forth on them, and or anything else you want to hold forth on once I shut up, is the two things were, one, learning how to see the tendency toward anger and to give it a name, you know, and every time the Robert Johnson rears his head within my mind, I'm like better now at seeing, oh yeah, it's Robert Johnson, and that kind of defangs the monster. And then the other thing is to you taught me this little thing called welcome to the party, which is a little sort of mantra, a little thing I can say to myself when I'm getting pissed at myself during meditation for getting distracted. So I just said a lot, and there are a lot of things in there for you to react to or not, but I'll shut up and let you go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the first thing to say is you're not as much of an asshole as you think you are. I mean, you can be a dick, and it was more like coming out as sort of snarky comments, but I never really felt like, I think you still do hold it together in a lot of ways. I never really felt the full brunt of that. Like, I think you are hard on yourself in that way, but there is definitely a severe quality. There had been a severe quality to your practice where just this, you know, really, really hard on yourself for a certain expectation that this meditation's always got to go this way, or it's got to go well, and hard on yourself when it wasn't. And we began to see that this was part of this program, this anger program, and we gave it a name, the Robert Johnson. So after your granddad. And so this is something I can definitely talk a lot about. And it's a revelation. I think it was probably my first big revelation in meditating, actually. And that was when I started to get still, I would realize that there were these, in a sense, these different programs or that were running for me, and then that run for all of us. Like, and what I mean by that is there'd be a certain pattern of thinking that I would get into, often related with moods. So I'm just using myself as an example, and I'll use you as well just because we're the two experimental guinea pigs. But everyone listening can apply it to their own lives. So, for example, you're in a bad mood and you're feeling kind of angry. There's often an inner voice kind of narrating your anger or itemizing your lists of your slights and your injuries or whatever it is. There's a particular feeling in the body, like a tension and a contraction, or maybe your jaw hurts or things are bearing down. And from the inside that program, or what do you want to call it, inside that mood, that personality, everything, you see everything through that filter of being that anger. Your life is, everything's, you're pissed about this. Everyone who's coming up to you, you're interpreting it in a slightly angry way. That becomes the filter of how you experience things. And I just use anger as one, but it's the same when if you're feeling kind of lost or doomed, or you're feeling depressed, you know, it suddenly becomes the new world and everything is interpreted through that. Everything you've ever done that was any good now seems like reinterpreted in that light. Something I struggle with is the overexcitement, like hypomania. I get so totally psyched about something that I'm then lost in that piece. So we get these are patterns of acting and relating that they're habits that we've created. You know, they're related to our moods, but the more we repeat them, the deeper they get. And so what I started to see is that you were really deep in this habit, this sort of Robert Johnson program of like holding yourself to this really high standard, kind of angry at yourself for not meditating the way you imagined them to, angry at other people. So very friendly and affable on the outside, but you have this opinion track running around where people are failing in the ways that they shouldn't be failing. And I mean, just like every other human being, you've got these programs. And so we started to get curious, what is this thing that comes up for you? And when it happens, because it happens, of course, in sitting as much as it does during the day, can we begin to notice what it's made out of? And that's what's the big insight with mindfulness, or when you start to get into really noticing patterns, this is where Shinzen is a genius, is that often our patterns, they're made of like, you know, they're made of a little bit of images. They're made of talk, a pattern of self-talk. They're made of particular body sensations and feelings. And if you can actually begin to notice, okay, yeah, I'm having this bit of talk in my head. I'm having these feelings in my body. Then you can pop out of it. And one of the ways to do it is to give it a name. So like I have in my practice, I have like a dozen different programs or personalities, whatever you want to call them, that I've noticed that I can get into. And now in life, when I start to go to that place, to one of those places, I can go, oh, yeah, I recognize this. This is El Grandioso, or this is the Catastrophist, or this is Lost Jeff, or Angry Jeff, or whatever it is. I can kind of see that that program has taken over because I've learned to notice the body feelings of it. I've learned to notice the refrains. And I'm literally, this is the magic of the practice. You notice it, you give it a name, you can pop out of it. And it's amazing how quickly that can happen. And that was, so that was one of the things we definitely work with. And I mean, I'll let you talk about how well it worked or didn't work for you, but because you were really resistant first. You didn't like the idea of giving it a name. It sounded too cutesy or something, but it is, can be really valuable.
Yeah, no, I thought it was, you told me one night on the bus, you know, we would have hours and hours. We would shoot during the day for a couple of hours, but then we would have these long bus rides, which actually were magnificent, in my opinion. They were, we would do hours and hours of just chatting, which were, I loved it. You know, just talking to you and talking to the other people on the team, I just loved it. Some really happy memories. And one night, you mentioned that you had this inner program called El Grandioso, who was sort of the, I think you described it as a cheerleader in your corner who was, you know, egging you on, telling you how great you were. And obviously it was a result of some insecurity that you had as a, as being a kid who had to wear a leash, essentially. and so El Grandioso came about, and you
has huge hair, El Grandioso.
What's
sorry,
that?
I just had to mention he has fantastic hair.
Oh, I'm sure he does. Yeah. Yeah. Werewolves of London. And so you then recommended that, you know, you've got this Robert Johnson and I'm sure others, you know, you should name him. And I was like, I don't know, it seemed kind of corny. But as time progressed, especially I think, you know, when I was struggling in the aftermath of the road trip in the writing of the book, you know, I did start to do it. And I now have like five or six people, programs, inner programs that I notice come back really frequently. And as cheesy as it may sound, the simple act of giving it a name, it doesn't mean you, I mean, I'm not like totally personifying it and having some imagery of, you know, Robert Johnson in a Little Bo Peep outfit or anything like that. It's more just like I notice the pattern arising, all the body sensations and images and thought flavors, and I'm like, ah, it's Robert Johnson. And it kind of just like it's like the Wizard of Oz. It's like you see it's just like a little old guy behind a curtain, and you can let it pass. And what you did that for me turned out to be the truly brilliant add-on that has as well the combination of naming and seeing these programs with another thing that you introduced that has utterly transformed my practice is to not only to see them, but because in the seeing there can be some hostility. There can be like, oh, you know, there's a way in which you see El Grandioso or you see Robert Johnson and you're mad that they're there. But there was something else you did, which is you said, add this little mantra of when you see any distraction, or particularly distractions that you really don't want to be seeing, force yourself to say, welcome to the party. And that, for me, as a guy who had so much inner hostility, self-directed hostility, you know, anger at my own mind for not doing what I wanted it to do, forcing myself to say welcome to the party whenever I get distracted, even if I don't mean it. I mean, I almost never mean it, but just that fake it till you make it spirit of using this little mantra has, again, utterly transformed my practice. So as much gratitude as you may feel toward me, it is, I promise you, fully, fully requited.
Well, I appreciate it. I mean, that is the, I think that is the, that is really the deep part of this practice. That, and that welcoming attitude is one that every teacher will talk about. It's there all over the traditions. And the idea is that we have all these subtle antagonisms about how we're trying to, we want, like things, we like this, we don't like that, how we want the world to be. But the world is how it is. And it, to a proper assessment of your life means accepting what is actually happening in this moment as what is happening and letting it be there. And it's only through letting it be there that you can, you know, really best address what's happening. And then you can move on to the next moment, you know. And particularly when you realize with these programs internally, these things, these are all strategies that you have developed that have to try to help you, that your body mind has developed to try to help you, brain has developed. And in a way, they came from this place, this caring place within the organism. And if you can start to see everything as it's just, they're just patterns that went wrong. Like any pattern after a while starts to get grotesque, the more it gets repeated, you know, I mean, in terms of our negative habits, because you are what you repeatedly do. You just keep repeating these things again and again, and they can start to, so what once worked starts to become now a problem. All of a sudden you yell when you merely needed to be emphatic, or you hit when you merely needed to yell, or you kill when you merely needed to hit. Like the way things get upscaled, the way they build up and they get worse and worse. And so those programs that started out as being trying to be adaptive got kind of led us in this place that's no longer working for us. But so the way to work with it is to say, okay, is to accept them, is to embrace them in this moment as being part of what's happening. And it's only through opening to them and embracing them that the energy of those patterns can start to drain out. And that is the magic of the practice, that this is the good news. You know, we are not uniquely doomed. You know, it doesn't matter how deep you are in these tracks. As you start to notice them and open to them and accept them, it's only in the accepting that they start to lose the momentum, and you can start to reverse some of these habits and create better habits, and good habits build in the same way. So this is very deep what we're talking about, the possibilities of human transformation. It all hinges on this piece right here, on this equanimity piece, this welcoming piece, and even more so if you can bring in a caring dimension to it. It just accelerates the changes that can happen. And it's so, and every teacher talks about this, you know, they have their own ways of talking about it. Sharon talks about this all the time. Joseph talks about this all the time. You know, this is meditation 101, but when you live it, then it becomes real for you. You start to see, okay, that's what it actually means to be welcoming, and all these subtle ways in which we're not that way.
You know, you're right. And I had studied meditation for many, many years less than a decade, but for me it felt like a long time, before we did this book. And I had heard teachers say a million times that, you know, how you have to have a welcoming attitude toward your distractions and have what they call self-compassion, and to, as they say in teacherly circles, you know, hold your emotions with, loving kindness, and all this blah, blah, blah. And my, first of all, I don't like that kind of talk. I don't think it's wrong. It's just that for me as a skeptic and a guy, I guess, like, it's that kind of talk, just I just reflexively reject it, which is stupid and didn't redound to my benefit, clearly. And also, I think there was this cocky assumption that, you know, I was going to win at meditation. You know, that the need to forgive yourself and begin again, as it, which is the practice of meditation, really only applied to other people because I was going to ace this thing, and which is again just toweringly stupid. And so, yes, I had heard teachers say this to me. You know, everything you just said about equanimity and even the caring piece, to sort of learn to care about yourself. But I just thought it was too sappy, and you were the right guy at the right time, and we had enough proximity. You know, like there's a huge privilege. You know, for most meditators, don't get to spend 11 or 12 days living on a bus with one of their all-time favorite meditation teachers. So you were the right guy with the right and with the right amount of proximity standing to say, hey, Dan, I've really noticed this thing, and to make points to me that were inarguable. So it really landed.
Yeah. Well, thank you. It was such a fun trip. But I mean, there's a point I want to make here that I think is really important to say, and it really trying to look at the big picture. You know, meditation is a training in how to be. Actually, your life is a training in how to be, because it's where the training happens. You're constantly being. So, however you are in life, whatever attitude you have to your own life is a habit that is getting reinforced. So when you're sitting, the attitude you have to your practice is the thing you're training. So that's why it's so important to have this fundamentally welcoming attitude. If you have a fundamentally judgmental attitude, or whatever it is, that is also going to get more deeply trained. So you really need to look when you're sitting at how you're approaching the whole practice in the first place. Like that's why we talk so much in the book about the specific training of skills. Like what skills are being trained here? And so there's the concentration. We know that. There's the clarity. We know that. But there's this equanimity piece around being genuinely open to the experience. And then there's the enjoyment piece, which is another thing that we talked a lot about, which is deciding to be open to the possibility that this is something that you can enjoy, that you don't have to go into it with your like braced or with your backup, but that like, hey, even just sitting here doing nothing, that is actually meditation, by the way. There are many practices that are all about that, or many traditions. Just sitting and doing nothing and enjoying your being, as I would say, enjoying the fact that you exist, the feeling of just breathing, being here, just that alone is a deeply healing practice. It is a training in learning to accept yourself in this moment as you are. And there is no more fundamental training than that. So that is, it's really important to kind of keep that in mind when we're practicing, like as almost the baseline. And of course we have to be easy with ourselves, because we're not going to always be in that baseline and being able to just sit here and say, okay, yeah, I'm here and I'm okay with being here. We're going to have things we're worried about. We're going to be off, lost, different stuff. We're going to have, and there's a place for training specific skills too, about being more focused in these things too. But if you surround your focus training with this severe, unhappy, I got to get through this feeling, well, you're just reinforcing that. And then you're going counter to the grain of where meditation actually wants to take you.
Yeah. And one of the last things you said there is truly what allowed me to do this, because you're not saying all of a sudden on demand, you've got to be totally psyched about everything and everyone. What you're saying is you decide that you're going to incline your mind in that direction and train yourself to try to get better at that. And there's a huge fake it or make it component to that, which is, so for me, when I see Robert Johnson arising, or I see any of my other annoying inner neurotic programs coming up in meditation, the practice of saying welcome to the party, even when I don't mean it, over time actually can transform your attitude. And I've noticed that when I see Robert Johnson now or any of these other things, that like actually I actually break out into a smile. And it's unaffected. It starts as an affected, forced practice, but it turns into something else, and that's why it's a training. It's made a big difference for me. This has been a phenomenal conversation. But I don't want to end it without asking you: is there something I should have asked that didn't? Any other points that you want to make that we should make before we call it a day?
No, I mean, that was a good conversation. I mean, there's a running joke through the book about mysticism, about me also wanting to get all mystic. And I think that I'm feeling a little bit of satisfaction right now, because I secretly just got mystical there by bringing in the enjoy your beingness thing. But there is another dimension to this practice, you know, which I like to point to, and I think is really important to have as a motivation for people, which is that there is something very beautiful and mysterious about this act of coming into the present moment, of welcoming what's there. And it starts out, our focus is more on trying to work through the challenges that are preventing us from being there. So seeing these patterns that sometimes can hurt us, that are destructive or that aren't really helping us, the people around us. And that's a big part of practice. But there's the flip side to that, which is this reorientation that starts to happen when you begin to feel what's below those patterns, when you begin to feel that there is this openness, there's a kind of presence in your life that is really exquisite. And it's not just feeling blissed out, it's the mystery and depth of this life that you start to feel, and the meaningfulness of it, and you start to connect to it. And it is there percolating up, and it is waiting to be discovered in a sense at every moment. And this, as you start to taste this, that is when your practice really becomes, the motivation changes. It's a privilege to now sit and experience your life in this way. And you and it's a privilege to be able to be with others in that way. And when you see people who are like that, and we know them naturally, we know we have friends, we have colleagues who are just naturally more in that space, you want to be around them more. There's something that they're tapping into that's very fundamental. And I just think it's important to, you know, talk about that too, that is, we don't just do this practice to wrestle with our tough stuff. We also do it to come more into the world in this very beautiful way and being more there for other people. And, you know, I just want to make sure that anyone who's listening knows that that dimension is real, and you actually already know it because you go in there all the time. You know, from moment to moment, we slip into those places where we're more available to our life, and when we're more open to what's going on, and it is deeply fulfilling, and people will know what I'm talking about. You know,
yeah. I mean, I think you'll find this satisfying. I mean, what you're talking about, I think of it kind of as just like the brute yet beautiful raw fact of our existence, that we can, in meditation, you could do the rudiments of the practice, noticing the breath, and then when you get distracted, start again. But then you can also kind of drop all of that and just like be alive, and then you'll get distracted. But there's something in that first few nanoseconds of just kind of noticing the fact that you're here is incredibly powerful. And you're right. During the trip, you had a way of lapsing into this kind of mystical schmystical talk, and in fact, in the third chapter of the book, we're actually talking to a Bethany Watson, who's one of the stars of the Elvis Duran and the Morning Show.
Yeah, that was funny.
A big radio star, and we're interviewing her about the fact that she's having trouble setting up a meditation practice, and she's saying something, and you're like, oh yeah, it's like just like kind of enjoying your beingness, and you know, she looks at you and like she's just complete like, you know, are you joking? Like, what? I don't understand what you're saying. But enjoying your beingness, which I think now will make sense to people based on everything else we've just, all the paragraphs you and I have just uttered leading up to this, is actually, there is something to that. And the thing I wanted to say that I thought you would find satisfying is that I find the phrase spontaneously arising in my own mind in meditation all the time. So
that makes me feel satisfied. Well, you know, as a mystic, you do struggle to try to articulate this. That's the whole point. That's why they gave it a category called mysticism, because you can't find language to describe it. But that thing of enjoying your being is, it's not just like, it just gets deeper and deeper and more mysterious and more fundamental. And that is what Buddhist insight practice points to. It's what the deep end of any contemplative practice points to. It's telling us that there is a continuum here that is, words can't describe it, but people know when they're in it, and the practice helps point us there. And if we're not talking about that, then we're not really talking about meditation. Like, you have got to honor that aspect of it, that this practice, which has been here for all of human history, has been a practice to help put us in touch with that truth. And my friend, your life is better. The more you are inside that truth, the more you know it, the more you can share it with others. There's just no ifs, ands, or doubts about it. It's the thing I know most in my life. And I am someone with a hell of a lot of mental health challenges, and yet that's still true. So, you know, just don't give up is what I'd say to, you know, beginner meditators, and because there's a lot there.
Well said. Well, thank you for doing this. Thank you for sticking it out through a ridiculously arduous writing process. Thank you for being my friend. You're the best. Thank you.
Thank you, bro. You're the best too, man. It's been such a wicked adventure. I'm psyched to see where we'll go next.
No more year-long deadlines, for sure.
No.
All right, Jeff. Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Okay, so that does it for another edition of the 10% Happier podcast. Please take a minute to leave us a rating and a review. And if you want to suggest topics or guests for the show, just hit me up on Twitter at Dan B. Harris. Special thanks to Lauren Efron, Josh Cohan, and the rest of the team here at ABC who helped make this thing possible. And remember, we're now on TuneIn. You can hear our new episodes there 5 days early on Fridays through the end of this year. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next week.
If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I'm Shimol Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now, I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully, no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.